House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is February, this 13th, it's the 14th, I believe.
The 14th, it's Valentine's Day.
Somebody light on the sheet here. 14th. Happy Valentine's Day and happy birthday, Oregon. So we have some announcements. We're not going to be able to do some bills today. We will be hearing House Bill 4009 and carrying over the work session to tomorrow. We're going to have a work session on House Bill 4050. We are carrying over House Bill 4056, House Bill 4097, House Bill 4116, House Bill 4149, and House Bill 4150. I apologize to people who are here for any of those, but in the short session, things are rolling, and sometimes we have a calendar we just can't control like we'd like to. We'll open a work session on House Bill 4050.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, you may recall 4050 we heard earlier in the week. It reorganizes the provisions of the crime of cockfighting and participation in cockfighting, maintaining both as Class C felonies. You have the dash three amendments before you today. The paperwork is ready. On the dash threes, the dash threes fix what may have been an older drafting error. There is an exemption in ORS 167.335 that exempts some people from the animal abuse statutes if they are, unless you can show gross negligence. But they are included within the prohibition on possession after conviction. And so it's kind of a strange circular argument there. This would straighten it out. Dash threes are here.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash three amendments into House Bill 4050.
Representative Williamson moves the dash three amendments into House Bill 4050. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4050 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 4050 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? And are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Okay, I'll carry the bill. Thank you. Open a public hearing on House Bill 4009.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, House Bill 4009 comes to you from Representative Sanchez. The underlying measure heightens the standard under which a child may be taken into protective custody without a protective custody order and allows reinstatement of terminated parental rights in specific circumstances. You have the dash three measures before you today, dash three amendment before you today, which replaces the measure and removes the provisions on protective custody orders and revises the process for reinstating parental rights.
Thank you. So ask Representative Sanchez, Angela Sherbo, Judge Waller, and Joanne Southey, please. Yeah, come on up. Go ahead, Representative, kick us off here.
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tana Sanchez. I'm the state representative for House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. This bill was actually brought to me by Youth Rights Justice as yet again another effort to try to reduce the number of kiddos in our child welfare system. We're all very aware of the fact that we are struggling right now, that we have a fairly significant audit findings, but this has been going on for a while, and we know that there are some answers. I, you know, as an advocate for many, many years in the child welfare system, I'm really trying to make sure that we can do something different here, that we can offer some opportunities for change and shift in our overall system in cooperation with the Department of Human Services. We want to work as a team. We've all come to some really good compromises in this bill and with a lot of folks on board. And I'm going to let Angela and the judge and Joanne speak to all the details of it. But I do want to just say that part of this process, in my opinion, is all of us being on the same page and figuring out how we can just do this a little bit differently. When we know there are problems, we know there are issues, how do we make life better for kids growing up in the child welfare system? How do we make sure that some of them who don't have to grow up in the child welfare system don't do that? That's all we're trying to do. We're trying to just move forward, return kids if they can be safely returned, and not remove them if they can be safely kept at home.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson. My name is Angela Sherbo. I'm a supervising attorney at Youth Rights and Justice, formerly known as the Juvenile Rights Project. I have had the privilege of working with all the women at this table, some of them for decades, on these issues. Judge Weller and I started as young public defenders in the Multnomah County Juvenile Court. We've represented countless, probably thousands, of children and parents in dependency cases and kids in delinquency cases, and we worked very closely with Representative Sanchez long before she was a colleague of yours in Multnomah County on issues of racial disparity and foster care. So what I wanted to do, I will talk very specifically about the bill, but I kind of wanted to introduce the conversation by talking about how much the juvenile code, which is not known to everybody, and this bill in particular, deal with what I think all of us will agree are the most intimate and important relationships that any of us have, and that's our relationships with our family. And many of us have been so lucky as to have those be really powerful, strong, stable relationships, but that's not the case for everybody in Oregon. And so when we brought this bill to you, it was to deal with the pieces of foster care that don't get all the public attention. The public attention goes to what happens when kids are in foster care, and we wanted to talk to you about what happens at the entrance and at the exit, which is kind of hidden from view. We are very happy that we've been able to work with all the partners and come up with these, with the Dash 3 amendments that at this point deal only with the exit portion, and we hope and look forward to working with all of those same partners again during the interim to work on the front end. What this bill does and who it affects is relatively small in terms of number of people that I expect to be taking advantage of the remedies that this bill provides. It's small in that respect. It is great in another respect, because that which it allows families to do is so profound. It permits families, children and parents, who have whose circumstances have changed since the law said you are no longer related to one another. It doesn't change how a daughter feels about a mother or a father feels about a son, but it changes the legal relationship. And the purpose of that change in the legal relationship in the statutes is to achieve adoption. And it's a necessary step. It's tragic, but it's necessary. And the best hopes and wishes of DOJ, judge, myself, all of us here, the Department of Human Services, is that fractured relationship will be replaced with a healthy relationship. But it is not always the case. We know that. Those of us sitting here know that personally. We can name names. We can think of sitting across from a child or sitting across from a parent where things have changed, and what is not in the eyes of the law a family is a family. And what we want to do is get the law to catch up with real life. And the reason we're here before you is because up until a couple of years ago, in a Court of Appeals decision called KW, and you'll have an opportunity to meet KW later, and I think she'll introduce herself by her actual name, a young woman who had done exactly what we ask of a parent to do and what this bill talks about in terms of reformation, redemption, rehabilitation, asked the court to set aside the judgment of termination of parental rights. And the trial court said, I don't think I have the discretion to do that under the current statutes. And the Court of Appeals said, you're right, trial court, you don't have the discretion. And the Court of Appeals went on to say, but it doesn't make much sense to have a that may be slightly strong. Perhaps it doesn't fit with the purpose of the juvenile code to have a prohibition against doing something that's in the best interest of a child, and specifically said perhaps the legislature would want to look at this. So I want to address two other things briefly, because I'm taking all of Representative Sanchez's time and probably some of theirs. One of the things that reasons we looked at these two decision points in the dependency process was that we know that every decision point disproportionately affects families of color. And with respect to this point, the adoption of children of color, we know two things. We know the statistics bear out that they are disproportionately represented in kids who are not placed and who age out of the foster care system. And we also know that DHS itself recognizes that and enumerates among the classes of children who are, quote, hard to adopt and for which adoption assistance is available, members of a ethnic, racial, or cultural minority, such as African American, Hispanic, Asian, Indian, or Pacific Islander. So we have both the statistics to show us, and we have DHS, the expert on this, saying so in their own regulations. So that's important, I think, for this committee to know. I know there were concerns when the bill was first crafted, and we've spent a lot of time working with our partners. I want to tell you, sort of in a fast bullet point, how we have safeguarded against the possibility of this being misused over the course of our negotiations. Number one, no one can file a motion to reinstate parental rights until at least 18 months after the original termination order and or 6 months after the appellate judgment, whichever is the later of the two. No one can file a motion to reinstate parental rights when a child is in an adoptive placement, and no one can file a motion to reinstate parental rights when an adoption is pending, when the first piece of paper is filed. And we know from the Department of Justice that we're beginning to do more and more, quote, petitionless adoptions, so when that first document in the petitionless adoption. That's the nothing. Once an expectation is there, that is not going to be a family that's disrupted by this bill. Only a child and DHS can file. The original version of the bill had parents filing. We have amended that, so only a child and only a child over 12, unless there's good cause shown, can file. The motion has to be in writing. It has to state a prima facie case, and that prima facie case is that the conditions that led to the termination on the parent have been ameliorated, that the parent wants the rights reinstated, that a child over 14 consents to the reinstatement, and then the court has to do what the court does best, and which is look at the best interests of the child, and the statute also gives some direction to the court on what to look at: health, safety, permanency, age, maturity, and ability to express preference. So those are all things that we are delegating to the juvenile court to make those decisions that I know keep juvenile judges up at night. And we want to give them the authority to act on behalf of kids and do the right thing. I don't expect this to affect very many children or parents at all. In Washington, a state that has a statute that we base this on, the number of these petitions in the 3 years after it was enacted were 10 in the first year, 9 in the second year, and 8 in the third year, and that's in a state that has 10,000 kids in foster care. So it's big in what it does for those few people it does something for, and I thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you. Judge Waller.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, members of the committee. My name is Nan Waller. I'm here testifying based upon my experience as a judge with 28 years of juvenile court experience on the bench. In Multnomah County, we are a one-judge, one-family court. So the children who I had in front of me when they were first brought into care are my children until they are out of care or age out of the system. There is probably no decision that a judge makes that is more difficult, whether they're in juvenile court or whether they're on the adult criminal bench, that is more difficult than the decision to terminate parental rights. There is probably equally no decision that is more difficult than the reviews that we are then required to hold on a regular basis to see a child growing older and not have fulfilled the promise that we make to them when we take the action of terminating parental rights to find them a permanent adoptive placement. I have seen too many of my children, and most of my caseload now are my children who are going to age out of foster care. They are children who we were not able to keep our promise to. There is also nothing more difficult as a judge than to be in the position where I know what the right thing to do is for a child and a parent who has rehabilitated themselves. but I don't have a legal vehicle for getting me there. And to sit on my hands and know what needs to happen when we've not been able to find an adoptive placement and get a child to permanency, that I don't have a way of getting us there. So this bill, in terms of what, based upon my 28 years of experience in a very busy juvenile court, it will not affect many people, but for the children it does affect. It allows us to keep our promise to them that they will have a family. Having children age out as legal orphans is a tragedy. They are without anyone, and everybody we know needs somebody, especially children who've grown up in the foster care system. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, members of the committee. My name is Joanne Southey. I'm the Deputy Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division at the Oregon Department of Justice. We're here today to support the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 4009. We'd like to thank Representative Sanchez for her interest, passion, and time that she has spent with us on this important issue. I'd also like to thank and appreciate Youth Rights and Justice and Ms. Sherbo and other YRJ folks' willingness to collaborate with DOJ on this bill and the subsequent amendments. This is a significant policy shift for our state, but it does bring Oregon in line with a number of other states that have recognized that there's a need to find a legal solution for children who have not been able, for whatever reason, to successfully achieve adoption. And as has been stated, this will likely only affect a small number of children who are legally freed for adoption each year, but it is an incredibly important group. And until now, they've had no clear legal avenue to reunite with a birth parent who has demonstrated a successful amelioration of the conducts or conditions that led to the termination of their parental rights. Reinstatement of parental rights is a recognition that the parent has changed their circumstances, but most importantly, takes into consideration that that reunification needs to be in the best interest of the child. And that what we look to, as has been stated, is their need to achieve permanency. This bill also recognizes the need to monitor reunification to ensure that the child's health, safety, and permanency needs are going to be met for a significant period of time, and that the parent and child are going to receive all necessary and appropriate services to ensure that that placement maintains and is the last placement for that child. And while the Section 1 of the original bill is not included here, we are very much committed to being part of that ongoing conversation and look forward to that discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. Appreciate your testimony. I call Danny Ledesma and Christalie Crane, please. Go to either in any order, but please remember to identify yourself for the record. Just state your name.
Okay, I'll go ahead and start. Hello, my name is Dr. Christalie Crane. I am an assistant professor in the School of Social Work at Portland State University. Thank you for hearing me. I'm here to talk a little bit about how this issue is really, to me, framed intersectionally. And when I mean intersectionally, I'm talking about not just the children who are removed from the civil process, but also the children who are removed in the criminal process, which some of these young people will be impacted by. Prior to moving to Oregon, I worked with the San Francisco Children of Incarcerated Parents Partnership, and we created the Children of Incarcerated Parents Bill of Rights, which I know the Oregon legislature adopted, and so thank you for that. A part of that includes, you know, the rights of the children being at the center of what happens to them and the what happens to their parents in removal. I think it's really important for folks to look at this bill as not just as a way to give their children back to parents who don't or aren't worthy of it necessarily, right? We want children to be safe, and this is a part of that process, and it's to create a civil process for that so that people can go back to their families. We know that even being removed is traumatic for folks, and not having the option to be reinstated with your family only furthers that traumatic exposure. And I think that being able to make that a legal process and to protect families in that particular way is something that is an opportunity for folks. With this particular law that's being, you know, considered by you all. I ask a couple things, right, that we take into consideration the Children of Incarcerated Parents Bill of Rights, not necessarily as the only consideration, but as a part of the model, right, where we're putting children at the center. When do they get to choose that they get to have their family back? Are they being considered in the removal process and in the reinstatement process? And are their families being considered? And when we ask them to be better and to be the parents that we need them to be for our communities to be safe, how are we rewarding that? And how are we keeping families together so our communities can be safe and successful? Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you, Dr. Crane.
Hi, my name is Dani Ledesma, and I'm with the Coalition of Communities of Color, which is an alliance of 19 culturally specific organizations that are dedicated to cross-cultural collective action for racial equity. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of this bill. I'm going to focus about sort of how I believe this bill ameliorates some of the issues around disproportionality. Families really are the foundation for Oregon's communities of color, and we think that this bill has an opportunity to strengthen that foundation. So as you've already heard, people of color and children of color are disproportionately overrepresented in Oregon's child welfare system, particularly Native American and African American children. And we know that this isn't a new problem. I'm reminded and both haunted by the fact that nearly a decade ago, then Governor Kulongosi stated that the time has come for us to move beyond good intentions to intentional action so we can ensure that children with the same needs are treated equitably, no matter the color of their skin. The Legislative Task Force on Disproportionality also found that the overuse of foster care in Oregon has led to dramatic disproportionality, which is a far-reaching problem with exorbitant costs and extraordinarily and devastating effects. And so, although disproportionality has decreased some in Oregon, we believe that more must be done. Data shows from DHS in 2016 that particularly Native American kids and African American kids were still more likely to be removed and placed in foster care than their peers. They were less likely to find a permanent home and more likely to age out without a permanent family. And this is not an urban problem. This isn't just happening in Multnomah County. Disproportionality can be found in counties across the state, including specifically Marion, Lane, Douglas, Jackson, and Klamath counties. At the Coalition, we really try to honor and respect the lived experiences of people of color. We think that parents and children who have been through the system are experts. But in addition to their opinions, we also know that the Children's Bureau leading scholars have all agreed that one of the best ways to decrease disproportionality is to promote policies that are grounded in keeping children safely with their own families. So we understand that there have been amendments, and we are committed to, of course, trying to continue to work on this problem. One of the reasons why we're disappointed about the amendments to remove the much-needed protection that would decrease the unlawful removal of children from their families is because we know that removal is such a serious issue, disproportionately devastating families of color. And we're missing an opportunity today to pass a meaningful solution to those unlawful removals. By not changing or challenging the removal provision, we are continuing to focus on foster care instead of prevention. That being said, we do think that the second half of the bill is really important, and we're still in support of the bill, which does provide an important family-focused protection that we believe will benefit children of color. That will allow children who have not found permanency, which is the goal, to reunite with rehabilitated parents rather than age out of the system alone. We believe that this bill will take one small but an important step towards decreasing disproportionality in the child welfare system. And it's our hope at the Coalition and amongst our members that we'll have the opportunity to work with this committee to better ensure that all of Oregon's vulnerable children and families receive the support and services they need to thrive. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Alexis Baska and Kendra Wright, please. And you can, whoever wants to speak first, but just please remember to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Go ahead. Chair Barker, members of the committee, sorry about that. My name is Alexis Baska. I am 21 years old, and I spent 5.5 years in Oregon's foster care system. I am in support of House Bill 4009 because I think that it will reinstate hope in families, something that if I wouldn't have had hope, I probably wouldn't be here today going through the foster care system. I think that we all need that light at the end of the tunnel to keep pushing on through tough situations. I grew up in Columbia County, a very small county in a small town, Vernonia, Oregon. The court systems are in St. Helens, about 45 minutes away, and we don't really have public transportation in that area. I entered after my father had passed away at the age of I was 15, and my mother struggles with addiction. I remember going to permanency hearings and my mother just being treated very poorly by the other adults in the room because essentially I'm a victim because of my mom. She might not necessarily see it that way, so to her it didn't make sense. It was kind of like nobody was in her corner. They wanted my mom to go through treatment. Well, we lived in Vernonia, and it was 45 minutes away. She had a suspended license at the time, and she didn't really have the means to be able to pay somebody to transport her back and forth or to move. And if she were to move to St. Helens, like they were asking of her, she'd be 45 minutes away from me, and I would have no way to see her. As soon as she saw that her rights were going to be terminated, my mother started giving up. She started losing hope, which I can't blame her when you feel like everyone is against you and the one thing that means the world to you is taken away and you feel like you're running but you'll never reach that finish line. It's devastating. It took away all of her hope. As soon as her rights were terminated, my mother's vices really called to her. She was at rock bottom, and I was more worried about her than I ever had in my whole life. I think that had she had more time or had she had the hope of being able to get me back at some point, that it would have been a very different outcome. I aged out of Oregon's foster care system. I was never reunited. I was never adopted. Therefore, the system essentially failed me. And I think that if she would have had the hope that maybe right now I don't have the resources that it takes to be able to be the parent that my child needs me to be, that eventually she would. I think that we put unfair timelines on things such as people's lives that can't always be met. I mean, life happens. We have struggles, we have ups, we have downs, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it will always be that way. Since then, my mom is doing a lot better. I now have a relationship with her, thankfully, but it's been hard. I had a lot of resentment for not being returned home, that she couldn't just figure it out, because to me it felt that simple. I'm not somebody that struggles with addiction. I could give up anything tomorrow. So it was really hard for me to understand where she was coming from. And, you know, everybody else makes her seem like a bad guy. So to me, it's easy to put the blame on her and not see where she was coming from. She's struggled with addiction long before I was born. And it's not as simple as snapping your fingers. I think that this bill would reinstate hope in so many families that feel that they're forever broken. It would help with the relationships between the youth or children and the parent or parents, because even though right now it's bad and maybe their parental rights are terminated, it doesn't mean that that's forever. It's not permanent. It means that they can try, that they still have a chance to
have a family. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Representative and Chair, Vice Chair. My name is Kendra Wright. I'm 30 years old, and I'm the mother of Celine Lasky, who is 12 years old. Although I am Celine's biological mother, and although she calls me mom, I am actively involved in parenting her. I am not her legal mother. My parental rights were terminated in 2012. At that time, I was serving a sentence at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility for nonviolent crimes that were related to my drug addiction. Parenting Celine when she was little, I was able to be a safe and loving parent to her for about the first 5 years of her life. I worked hard, and when I wasn't working, I spent my time with Celine. I found I was able to manage these responsibilities. It felt natural to me. And I had a lot of family support, especially from my grandparents. When Celine was about 5, I went through some traumatic events. I had been married, divorced, had some health problems I was dealing with, and started going through some depression. I felt overwhelmed, and I started to use drugs to cope. Around this time, I started using drugs. I lost my job. I became more depressed. Then I lost my housing. During this time, I had made arrangements for other people to look after Celine, but DHS got involved. My grandparents called and told me that I couldn't have any contact with Celine until further notice, and that I needed to call DHS. I tried to work with DHS, but there were barriers. I tried my best to work with DHS, but with these barriers, I wasn't successful. I got sober for a short while, but still struggled to meet the expectations. When DHS decided to move towards a plan of adoption for Celine, I was devastated and relapsed. The cycle worsened from there. I got involved in criminal activity to support my drug addiction. In July of 2012, I was sentenced to Coffee Creek, and the state filed a petition to terminate my rights. I had a trial and lost. My rights were terminated in December of 2012. Things started to get better when I went to prison. The whole time I was using drugs, I pined after being a mom, pined after being a normal family again, but I didn't know how to get back to that place. At Coffee Creek, I could see reality, not muddled by drugs. I could see all the damage that I had created. At the same time, I was able to start being solution focused. I saw that I had a huge opportunity to do something different. It took a while, but I got signed up for Pathfinders, a parenting and cognitive thinking class. Then I got involved with the Family Preservation Project, and everything really started to turn around. I was able to become a full person again. I felt supported and cared about. I felt like I mattered. It took time to rebuild my relationship with my daughter. I finally had gotten permission from DHS to have Celine come and visit me, and my grandmother started bringing her every other weekend, but only because I was involved in the Family Preservation Project. The first couple of visits were awkward. Celine was 7 and a half by then, and I hadn't seen her in 18 months. She didn't know how to be with me. She didn't know if she could sit on my lap or hug me. Then she started to warm up to me again. On our second visit, we got to go outside, and that broke the ice. We were laughing and playing. It was amazing. Things only improved after that. We slowly rebuilt our relationship, and I let Celine take the lead as I followed. As visit by visit, I regained her trust. During this time, I appealed the judgment terminating my rights. We lost the appeal in February 2014. My grandparents, could have moved forward with the adoption, but they kept waiting because they didn't agree that Celine should have been adopted. My grandparents had wanted guardianship, but they weren't given that choice. They wanted to take care of Celine for as long as she needed them, but they also believed that if I could get better, I would be the best for Celine to be reunited with her mom. They knew that Celine did not want to be adopted, that she was attached to me, and that forcing an adoption was confusing and emotionally difficult for her. And they could see that I was working hard and making progress. They believed I could stay on track and get out and be successful. In May of 2014, we filed a motion in the trial court to ask the judgment terminating my rights to be set aside. We wanted to present evidence that all of us, me, my grandparents, and Celine, agreed it would be best for Celine to be in a guardianship instead of being adopted. We wanted to tell the judge that forcing an adoption on Celine would actually be emotionally harmful for her. We wanted to show the judge that I was making significant progress in addressing my issues while in prison and that I was rebuilding my relationship with Celine. We also wanted the judge to consider a recent psychological evaluation that gave me positive prognosis. In October 2014, we had a hearing on the motion to set aside the termination judgment. The judge held that the law did not give him the authority to set aside the judgment based on the child's best interests or a change in circumstances. He did not permit us to present evidence about what Celine needed, how I had made progress, or even that our family and Celine's caregivers thought it would be best. We appealed that decision too. We lost and petitioned the Oregon Supreme Court for review. While we were waiting to hear from the court, I was released from Coffee Creek after 39 months. By that time, I completed treatment, I participated in many programs, and I had worked as a carpenter for 2.5 years while maintaining clear conduct. In September 2016, I found out that the Supreme Court had not accepted review of our case. At that point, we had exhausted every option available to us. I told my grandparents that it was their choice whether they wanted to go forward with the adoption. At this time, they were the ones raising Celine and dealing with DHS on a regular basis. They were so exhausted and just wanted a normal life for Celine. So they went ahead and adopted her, and the DHS case finally closed. I do want to mention that the DHS workers towards the end of all of this were supportive of my relationship with Celine, and they even thought that guardianship would have been a better plan. After I released from prison, I moved into a clean and sober housing and immediately started working at a detox center. I am now a peer support specialist for people with mental illness through an organization called Shelter Care, and I love my job. There's a strong sense of community. It's like a big family. We help people who are homeless and suffer from mental illness. Our objective is to help them be successful in their own lives. I am also a mom to a new baby, so that takes up a lot of my time. There is so much joy in my life. I work, I take care of my kids, and I also do a lot to give back to my community and share my experience. I am part of a reentry task force, and I frequently speak on behalf of women in prison and children of incarcerated parents. I advocate for the legislature to provide funding to the Family Preservation Project, and I was involved with the Children of Incarcerated Parents Bill of Rights, which I am all so thankful that this legislator supported in 2017. I was also part of a documentary about incarcerated mothers in Oregon called Mothering Inside. Throughout all of this, my relationship with Celine has kept getting stronger. Today, Celine is a dynamic, creative, and sensitive 12-year-old. She pushes boundaries like all 12-year-olds, but she is respectful and kind and listens to what I have to say. I see her on the weekends, and I attend all of her school events and performances. I invited her to be a part of the birth of her sister. We are very close. We are very normal. I am so glad to have my life with her again. From the time I got out of prison, and even while I was in prison, my grandparents and I co-parented on all the major decisions involving Celine's life. We treated the relationship as if we were one parent and they were the other. But Celine was also adopted by my grandparents, and that changes things. They are in charge of raising her. She lives with them. They are her day-to-day parents. They are the ones that get her report cards and the telephone calls from the doctor. They are legally responsible for her. If I had been able to get my parental rights back, I would have wanted to parent Celine full-time again. And I know that's what she would have wanted also. At this point, I can say with confidence that I would have been able to do it. My struggle has not been overcoming all the barriers to reentry that people talk about. My biggest struggle is not being able to wake my daughter up to get ready for school and not being the one to tell her to brush her teeth before bed. I don't get to do those things. That's the hardest thing. Everything else about getting out of prison has been cake compared to that. I don't think it should be that way. I think that Celine and I should have the option to have the life that we wanted legally. I know that Celine is the person who is most affected by this. She just wants me to be her regular mom. Instead, I'm this person who she still calls mom, who's a big part of her life, but she doesn't get to live with, who's not her regular full-time parent because she is adopted by someone else. Celine says that she just wants to be like all the other kids. There's shame and confusion and questions that go on with her situation. It's a reminder that something went really wrong in her past, that her mom was in prison and couldn't take care of her, that her grandparents had to adopt her. It makes it hard to heal. This is my story, and that's why I wanted to testify here today. I know not all children are as lucky as Celine and I. Not all children have grandparents who are willing and able to step up to care for them, who are patient and kind and believe in their child's ability to make a change the way my parents believed in me. For those children who are bouncing around in stranger foster care, this bill is even more important. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you for turning your life around like you're doing and really helping the rest of the Oregon and everybody else. I really appreciate that. And in another lifetime, I was with the state police in St. Helens and spent many time going back and forth to Vernonia. If you didn't have a driver's license, that is a long way away.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see where your mother would really feel trapped up there in Vernonia. So thank you very much for your testimony, too. It was very important for us to hear that. Thank you. We're gonna have somebody on the phone here for a quick conference. And Dr. Haraguchi, you could come up if you would like and be ready to go. All right, it's a doctor. Katie. I'm sorry, Katie, not doctor. Hi, this is Representative Jeff Barker. I'm chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. We have you on the speakerphone. Doctor, if you'd like to go ahead.
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Please go ahead and proceed. We're waiting for your testimony.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead, Doc. Go ahead and start talking.
Okay, great. Thank you. And members of the committee, my name is Dr. and I am a faculty member in the College of Social Work at the University of South Carolina. My research is specifically exploring the experiences of children and youth as they enter and exit the foster care system, and also the experiences they have, children and youth have, while in the foster care system in direct relation to experiences of grief and loss. I've conducted research for over a decade, and I've spoken with hundreds of young people about their experiences as they transition into the foster care system. And what the research shows is that despite what home a child may come from, we have different reasons for a child's removal. The removal from the family home is almost always traumatic for the child. And one of the questions I often receive is, well, if they're coming from a horrible home, isn't this in the best interest of the child? And my response is this, that we tend to focus a lot on the reason for removal, and there's a point to that, but that's not what I want to be talking about today. It's what the research shows in terms of when a child is removed, how does that affect the child? What we find is that children who are removed from their home experience various types of ambiguity, which will result in trauma if not mitigated, and sometimes these ambiguities cannot be mitigated. For example, when a child is removed from his or her home, they're removed from family, from friends, from communities, from siblings, from routine, from a lot of the things that they understand, and this is something we call the assumptive world, and so that shifts, and it becomes a significant life transition that can evoke trauma as a result of being having the world turned upside down. And so children can experience a lack of clarity about why they're in foster care, which is known as placement reason ambiguity, a lack of clarity about how long they're going to be in foster care, which many of us don't know the answer to, which is temporal ambiguity, not understanding where they're going, where they're going to be placed, with whom they're going to be placed, which is placement context ambiguity. And question is, well, if they're placed with kin, well, then they're not going to experience that because they know where they're going. The answer is not always. Some of the children I've spoken to have indicated that they've never met their family members who they're being placed with. So kinship placements, although, you know, we recommend that as being a first choice, isn't always going to mitigate these ambiguities, which I'm talking about today. We have relationship ambiguity, which is a lack of clarity about the people with whom they're going to be placed. A deep-seated fear of who are these people and are they going to hurt me? We have structural ambiguity, which is a lack of clarity about the meaning of foster care. What is that? And then we have ambiguous loss, which is considered one of the most traumatic types of loss that any human being can experience because the person is alive out there somewhere. This is a non-death loss, a theory coined by Pauline Voss, Dr. Pauline Voss, in the early 1970s, and she says that it's because the grief becomes frozen, because the individual doesn't know how to handle it, because the person's not dead, they're out there somewhere. And you don't really know if where they are in the family unit. And then we have role ambiguity, which is a lack of clarity about the role of that one has within the family unit. And so if I remove my mom or my brother and I'm placed into another family, am I still a son or a daughter? Am I still a brother or sister? I don't understand the new dynamic I'm in. There's tons of other things that the young people talk about, such as preferential treatment in the home. And I believe that one of the materials that was been added to this conversation today from one of the young people indicates that he or she was exposed to that, and my research supports that claim. So what I want to say is that removal is not a benign act. It is considered to be one of the most intensive interventions for the child welfare field. However, it has consequences when a child is removed, regardless of the reason for removal. And one of the things that the research shows is that we should not be removing children lightly. We need to acknowledge that when a child is removed, even for a day, we are causing harm that could potentially be worse than had we not removed the child and provide the proper services in place, because sadly what we see a lot of is we see neglect as being, you know, one of the overarching reasons for removal. But when neglect is confused with poverty, that's a whole other story. And I don't think that children should be removed, and again, this is sorry, my personal opinion, but for parents not having the right resources, so that we're now creating a double affliction on a family unit. Rather, the resources are provided to the family, the child can be raised with his or her parent or parents. And so that's what my research shows. There's a lot of grief that occurs when a child's in the foster care system, confusion, they act out. I've heard from young people telling me that no one ever paid attention. So over 212, I believe it was, that I interviewed, about a quarter of them indicated that no one at any point acknowledged their grief while they were in the foster care system. And so this is something we call disenfranchised grief, which can result in hopelessness and despair and turmoil and trauma. And so where are we placed with that? And what can we do about that? Well, we need to start to pay attention to the children and how they're experiencing the interventions that we sometimes consider to be in the best interest of the child. But truly, sometimes there's interventions that can be harmful, and we need to use them sparingly, and only in cases where we know for sure that it is about child safety and well-being.
Thank you for listening.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Mitchell. Questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Your research sounds fascinating, and I think it's a really good perspective for this committee to have. So thank you very much.
Great. Thank you. Are there any questions?
Not at this time. So thank
okay.
you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you, Vice Chair Williamson and members of the Judiciary Committee. My name's Katie Haraguchi. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, Oregon. My practice focuses on contested elder protective proceedings and trust and estate litigation. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 4009, and I appreciate Representative Sanchez for bringing this bill forward. I'm here today to share an experience that I had as a pro bono attorney for a family called the Nathan family. This case was my first involvement with the child welfare system in Oregon, and what I experienced fundamentally changed how I view Oregon's child welfare system, including the efficacy of our statutes and how we train our child welfare caseworkers. Hito and Hani Nathan are citizens of the Marshall Islands, a U.S. contract territory. In October of 2011, they were living in Eugene, Oregon with extended family members. And Hani Nathan accidentally discharged a legally owned handgun into the floor of the family's apartment. The neighbors called the police. Nobody was injured, but the police came to investigate. And upon learning that there was a young child living in the apartment, they called DHS and a child welfare worker came out. The Nathans don't speak English. They were a family of five living in a two-bedroom apartment in Eugene. And the caseworker spent about 4 hours out there on that day on Sunday. She got out there at about 11 a.m. on a Sunday morning. And during the course of the time that she was there, the police took the gun into evidence, issued a couple of citations, and went away. Partly due to the language barriers, according to this caseworker, she decided to remove the child from the home that day. She did not obtain a court order. She did not obtain judicial review. She did not, it appears from the DHS records, even actually discuss the situation with a supervisor prior to making her decision to remove R from the home. After about, R at the time that she was taken was the adopted child and biological grandchild of the Nathans. Because the Nathans initially identified themselves, again, there were language barriers, but because they initially identified themselves as grandparents, this caseworker chose not to include them as parties in the juvenile court proceeding that was initiated in court the next week. The Nathans sat in the hallway while the court hearing took place. Nobody, it appears, informed the judge that they were even there. After about 4 months, when the Nathans had not been able to get their child back from the foster care system or back from DHS, they were connected with me. At the time I was working at Miller Nash, and we had a significant pro bono program. And it took us about 4 months of intensive litigation and over 100 hours of attorney work in that time, just by me, not to mention some other folks in our office who worked on the case. And after 4 months of intensive litigation, on the day before the fact-finding hearing in our case, I got a call from the Oregon DOJ attorney who informed me that that DHS was dropping the allegations against my clients and that they could come pick R up at the foster home. In our subsequent civil lawsuit, one of the central issues that we debated was the difference between the federal constitutional standard of when a caseworker may remove a child without a court order or a warrant, and the language of Oregon statute ORS 419B150, particularly subsection A. And the federal standard, just to refresh folks, says that there's an immediate, a caseworker may remove a child without a court order when there is an immediate threat of serious bodily injury or death. The language of ORS 419B150 says that a caseworker may remove a child when the child's conditions or surroundings reasonably appear to be such as to jeopardize the child's welfare. In the testimony of the DHS caseworkers that we took during depositions and through the legal briefing, the language of the Oregon statute was used time and again to excuse the fact that this caseworker removed this child from a home on a Sunday morning when there was no emergency threat. The trial court dismissed our case. The Court of Appeals reversed and found that the removal was unconstitutional under the federal constitutional standard. I believe you have the case and the decision in your materials. What I'd really like to address today is a viewpoint that I have commonly heard and argued in my own home since I took this case and waded into the issue of child removals. And that issue is, wouldn't we rather err on the side of safety? Aren't we better off having kids removed from a potentially unsafe situation than left in a potentially unsafe situation? And I didn't quite hear the doctor's last name, but as you heard, removals are traumatic. What I experienced was that getting a child out of foster care once they have been placed in foster care is extraordinarily difficult. The legal resources that are required, the time that is required, is unimaginable on the side of the family, not to mention on the side of the agency. I'm the mother of two young daughters. They're 6 and 10. At the time, my oldest daughter was R's age. I didn't sleep when I had this case. I'm fiercely passionate about child welfare and the safety of children, but we are not better off authorizing wrongful removals in the state of Oregon. Each wrongful or unconstitutional removal puts a child into the foster system who should not be there. This diverts scarce resources from children who do need the support of foster care. Allowing for judicial oversight is going to make sure that our kids that are in dangerous situations still get into foster care, but it provides one safeguard to keep folks who shouldn't be in there out of the system, and it saves those resources for the kids who most need it. Litigating these wrongful removal issues is expensive and time-consuming, and as I've been told, intensely unpleasant for the participants. The caseworkers that we named as defendants were good people. During the depositions, it was difficult knowing that I was taking them away from their work. I was taking them away from important work. And in most of the cases, they had done exactly what they were trained to do. You might have to pay attention. Our caseworkers are extraordinarily stressed. Being questioned under oath by somebody like me isn't something that should be a part of their job duties unnecessarily. This is a stress that could have been avoided with clarity in the law. clarity in our processes and clarity in our training comes from, first, the clarity in the language of our statutes. And in the difficult and muddy waters of child welfare work, this legislature can provide clarity in the law by passing House Bill 4009. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Kimberly McCullough, Patty Trezon, and Laura Hallett, please. Hallett.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I am here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon today. We support House Bill 4009. We support the entire bill, but we also understand that work has been done and support the bill as amended and would love to be part of any process discussing the pieces of the bill that are coming out. I just want to bring a sort of civil liberties, civil rights frame to this discussion. At the ACLU, we really see these types of issues as a balance between competing rights. On the one hand, there are situations when the state needs to step up and protect children, obviously. On the other hand, there are issues with state intervention. It raises a lot of civil liberties issues, the rights to privacy of the family and the parents, the right to parenthood, and also state intervention in some cases does lead to substantial harm for the child. Because of that, we think that policy needs to really balance those rights, and that's why we actually at the ACLU have a sort of model policy for these types of proceedings. And when I first reviewed this bill, I was so excited because I basically got to check every single box. All of the things that are in our model policy are in this bill, and I have outlined what those things in the policy are in the testimony that we have submitted. Just really happy to be able to be here and testify in support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
My name is Patty Terzian. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Network of Child Abuse Intervention Centers. Chair Barker, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide some testimony on this bill. I work with child abuse intervention centers. Those are sometimes also referred to as child advocacy centers around the state of Oregon. There are, and our role in working with those centers is to provide support for centers who are working toward meeting best practice standards or already meeting best practice standards in terms of providing services for children when there's concerns of abuse. We provide a lot of training and technical support and assistance to those centers. There's currently 24 centers across the state of Oregon that are all independent from each other, and they offer a range of services for children, including forensic interviews, medical and mental health services, and they also work collaboratively with child welfare workers, law enforcement, and other partners in the community to provide those services. Our centers had some concerns with the language in the original bill in Section 1, which we understand has been addressed and believe it's addressed in the drafted amendment, so we're very happy to see that. And we just wanted to take the opportunity to thank the proponents for the bill for being willing to make some of the concessions around that language, their willingness to take time to craft a bill that addresses those intended concerns, and also make sure that we're keeping kids safe. We also understand that there may be an interim work group that is pulled together to work on this issue, and we are hoping to be included as partners in that work group. We understand it may be beneficial to have a larger conversation about DHS and these dependency cases, but as experts in the area of child abuse intervention, we'd like to be at the table to be part of those conversations and the conversations around this particular bill. I want to thank members of the committee for your consideration and also just offer ourselves as a resource to you if you should have questions about child abuse intervention in the state of Oregon or nationally. We are happy to help answer questions for you now and in the future.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and committee. My name is Laura Hallett. I'm of Portland, Oregon. I'm a grandmother and a former relative foster care provider and an Oregon member of the National Family Advocacy Team, and the newly formed Foster Care Reduction Project, which advocates for change within the child abuse and neglect system to assure that the due process to all that are involved in the system through the use of social media. I'm here today in support of House Bill 4009. Raising the standard for taking a child into protective custody without a court order is just the beginning to fixing a very broken system. And it's about foster care. This is about foster care. No, actually, it's about something more precious and unique, irreplaceable. Than foster care, it's about our families. We're all familiar with the jaw-dropping audit that came out not too long ago, but I want to ask how we can reduce the number of children that are entering into the foster care system every day. The day of remove the child and confirm the allegations later are well past. As Mr. Wexler of the National Coalition for Child Protective Reform states in a community, in the commentary I provided in the earlier, most cases are nothing like the horror stories. Far more common are cases in which family poverty is confused with neglect. Other cases fall between the extremes. Massive studies of typical cases show that children left in our homes fare better in life than even comparably maltreated children placed in foster care. A study of foster children in Oregon and Washington state showed that the foster care system churns out the walking wounded 4 times out of 5. All the harm occurs even when the foster home is a good one, and the majority of them are good ones. But study after study, including 2 from Oregon, found abuse in 1/4 to 1/3 of foster homes. The rate of abuse in group homes and institutions even worse. All the time, money, effort wasted on false allegations, cases in which family poverty is confused with neglect and needless foster care. As in the Fabrini and Ziegler case in Southern Oregon. In effect, stolen from finding children in real danger who really need to be taken into foster care. I would also ask that you speak to the children whom this affects, the ones who have been returned home after it was found there was not neglect or abuse. You'll find more statements such as the one I sent you from the young Oregonian foster care, young Oregonian to the Oregon, to the Foster Care Reduction Project that I've also submitted to this committee. I could read this note, give it a voice, but I believe that each committee member should give this child a voice. I'll only repeat his final statement. Please change the foster care system. Do we have an obligation to prevent, to whatever way possible, the devastating and abiding trauma that a child suffers when he is taken from the less than high income, the less than well educated, less than almost perfect family, the family he is permanently bonded to, the family he has loved with his whole heart? Absolutely. We have an obligation to prevent that. By raising the standard for taking a child into protective custody without a court order, we are just beginning to fix a very broken system. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, panel. Cynthia Stinson and Amanda Dalton, please. Amanda, why don't you go first on this?
Great, Chair Barker and members of the committee. Amanda Dalton, I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We'll be very brief. We really just wanted to thank Rep. Sanchez for the time that she's put into this bill, her passion behind its objectives. We had raised concerns with the bill originally as introduced. We're part of the stakeholder group and look forward to being part of the interim conversation to address Section 1 in a meaningful way. And so wanted to make sure that you heard that from us on the record.
Thank you very much.
Chair Barker, Vice Chair Williamson, members of the committee, my name is Cynthia Stinson. I'm the Legislative Coordinator for Child Welfare at Department of Human Services, and just here to say that we took part in the formulation of the Dash 3 amendments and really appreciate the opportunity to weigh in on those, and also that we welcome the opportunity to continue to work together on the first part of this bill in the interim.
Representative Stark, just a second, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. I have a few questions for DHS. Cynthia, these amendments, conceptually, I'm very in favor of them. I have some questions about the actual details of how things would be carried out. One of them being, on the, you don't have to look up the direct, but on page 3, lines 7 through 10, talks about in determining whether to reinstate the, of parental rights, it is the whether or not it's in the board's best interest, lays out a few things. And has DHS already decided, are there some immediate disqualifiers that, you know, if certain types of offenses were what led to, a TPR, would those offenses forever be disqualifiers, such as sexual abuse, or would those be considered as well? How do you make that determination?
Chair Barker, Representative Stark, I'm going to have to get back to you on that. I'm not an expert in the inner workings of the TPR process, but it's a good question, and I will get back to the committee with that answer.
Okay. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
That kind of leads to the second question for me. I know, because I've been through it many, many times now, when you move into a permanency situation with a family, whether it's a guardianship or whether it's, adoptive and so forth, there's a six-month probational period, and during that period, you have people in your home, and prior to that period, you have a home study. In the idea here, if we reinstate parental rights, do we still go through as an agency the same type of process as if somebody else were to take guardianship to really double check, yes, the scenario is quality as the way it should be, as if we were to do a different type of placement? What would the process be at that point?
Chair Barker, Representative Stark, that is a good question. I was just talking with staff about that yesterday. I believe that our intention would be to, if we're not able to, because of the new language, to make rule that would allow us to do that. But I can go back and make sure that concern is registered and get another answer. I believe that the work group, when we were working together, intended for that kind of process to take place.
Okay. Another follow-up?
Please.
Thank you. And when I hate any time we talk about children, I hate saying the cost, because, this is something that we need to invest in. Have you guys run the numbers yet as to, between increased hearings and so forth, what the cost to reinstate would be?
Chair Barker, Representative Stark, we are looking at that, although we would consider that as kind of part of our regular course of business, and we anticipate that the number of cases that this would affect would be relatively small, around 7 to 10 was what we anticipated based on what's happening in Washington, and the Dash-3 amendments were borrowed heavily from the Washington model.
Is that per year or per biennium? The 7 to 10?
I'm not sure, year, I believe.
Okay, thank you. That's all for the moment.
Representative Sanchez, please.
Thank you, Chair Barker. If I recall correctly, though, I wanted to just note that we offered to remove the emergency clause, so that we could, so DHS and everyone else involved can have some time to come to some real understanding of how things will work. So there is no emergency clause on the bill.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. And I just want to make a brief statement here that I think the best course here is to call for a work group to address the issues around taking a child into protective custody. I'd like Representative Sanchez to lead this work group, have the assistance of YRJ, DOJ, DHS, and ODAA, and all of the stakeholders need to be at the table. I expect to report back to this committee during the November interim legislative days. I look forward to recommendations to move forward in the 2019 session. As I said at the top of the hearing, we're carrying over the work session on this measure until tomorrow, but I want to get the direction on the work group to you all while you're here. Thank you. Okay. Anything else before the committee? We stand adjourned. Thank you.